Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is award-winning game audio composer Brian Schmidt. But first of all, it looks like streaming exclusives might be going away. Yeah, record labels are really down on exclusives these days, and one of the reasons why is they think that they're confusing fans. Now, just to be clear, an exclusive basically means that a streaming service like Spotify or Tidal or Apple Music gets the exclusive right to play a release for a certain period of time, and that can't be played anywhere else in that time period. Now, in exchange for that exclusive, usually the artist gets a modest upfront fee and the promise of millions in ad dollars, which may go to online, it may go to billboards, it may go to television. So this is something that's really important to an artist if they want to stick out from the pack. Now, Apple has done more than 70 of these in the last year or so, and that's actually helped propel their subscriber rate up to about 17 million. And of course, they're in a big battle with Spotify right now. Spotify has 39 million paid subscribers. But what's happening is Spotify is now kind of retaliating. So if someone has an exclusive on Apple Music, Spotify won't promote that album or that artist, as a matter of fact. And Katy Perry just had that happen in a bad way, where in fact, she had a single that came out. Spotify did nothing with it and actually even pulled it from a lot of playlists. And as a result, the single basically did nothing worldwide. Kind of a first for her, because almost everything she touches turns to gold, but not this time. So one thing that might happen, and I think this would actually be a good thing, is that exclusives might be just on a per tier basis. So basically what a record label will say to all labels is, okay, you want this release, you can have it, but it has to be only on your paid tier. It can't be on the free tier. So hopefully that would be enough to compel people to go from being a free subscriber to a paid subscriber. So that makes a lot more sense than the exclusives that we have today. So this is changing day by day how this works, because let's face it, there's a lot of people that are not happy with this whole exclusives thing, and it looks like they may be going away. So watch and see what happens over the coming weeks. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions at bobbyownercircle.com. Don't forget to check out my 101 Mixing Tricks program and my other online video courses at bobbyosinskicourses.com. To check out my music industry and music production blogs, just go to bobbyosinski.com to find the links, and you can also read excerpts from my books there. Now, I just read an interesting article by Rob Taviglione on the Pro Sound Network, and this is all about headphone freakout solutions. So I'll just mention a number of them here, because there's a few that I hadn't thought of before. So the first thing is always check the headphones before the session begins. And this is just common sense. Every engineer I know does this and just makes sure there's no intermittence, that they work just perfectly, and there's no complaints. The second thing is have More Me ready. Basically what that is on the headphone box somewhere, there has to be a knob that's More Me. So for a vocalist, if they want to turn themselves up or down, they know exactly where to go for that. If it's a guitar player, whoever's doing the overdub, they know the More Me and they know where it's at. The third thing is something I haven't thought about, but it's very interesting. It's when you're recording vocals, flip the polarity on the microphone, and that will make the vocals sit better in the phones. Now, of course, what this means is you'll have to flip it back later when it comes to mixing, but that's okay too. Anything that you can do to get the vocalists more comfortable and just like their phones better, that's what you got to do, and it's a really good idea. Another one is to have open back headphones available. And again, something I hadn't thought about much and haven't used for a long, long time, but it makes perfect sense. So it appears that younger musicians and vocalists much prefer closed headphones, but the older you get, the more likely you are to like open headphones. So, of course, for drummers who can't hear the kick drum, and no matter what you do to put it in their phones, it's just not enough, this is one way to get around that. For guitarists that are trying to get feedback, this is another way to do it. For harmony vocalists that can't really hear the blend, this is yet another way to do it. So remember these things to make your overdub session go a little smoother. Always check the phones. Have a More Me control ready. Flip the polarity of the microphone when recording vocals. And also have some open back headphones available. My guest today is game audio composer and sound designer Brian Schmidt. Brian's been the composer and sound designer for over 150 video games, as well as being the architect for the Xbox audio system and the Exact Game Audio tool. He's also the creator of GameSoundCon, a conference and seminar in composing video game music and video game sound design for the professional audio community. I spoke with Brian via Skype from his studio in the Seattle area. Tell me about GameSoundCon. What's the skinny on it?
What's the skinny on GameSoundCon? So I started GameSoundCon in 2009, shortly after I left Microsoft, where I was where I worked for 10 years. The reason I started it is when I was at Microsoft, I spent a lot of time with the Xbox team giving lots of talks to people about how to develop for the Xbox. There are a lot of really cool audio capabilities. And that was right about the time the technology in games had evolved enough that you didn't have to be kind of a computer programmer and composer to be able to do sounds for games. And as a result, around that time, 2001, 2002, a lot of composers from more traditional media started entering games and doing games. And games are actually pretty specialized. They're actually quite different than traditional linear media like film or television. And, you know, as I was talking to developers in, San Francisco, where a lot of the composers and sound designers were tripping over the same kinds of things as they tried to move from doing music for a movie to music for games. And so after I left Microsoft, I kept thinking, there's probably, you know, there'll probably be a lot of value to having a concentrated place where people who want to learn the difference between doing work for games and work for more traditional media, both in terms of technology challenges and creativity challenges, and also the different business climate, that that I started GameSoundCon. It was originally targeted at that, you know, I'm a TV composer, I want to do games. And over the last couple of years, it's been expanded to now include people who have done a whole lot of games, as well as, you know, we still do, of course, have the sessions for people who want to learn sort of the, you know, drink game audio from a fire hose for 2 days.
Yeah. What's your background? Are you an audio person or a composer? Do you have that in your background at all?
Yeah, I have a music degree and computer science degree. So I've been a composer for games for, what year is this? 29 years now. So I started in 87, back when you had to be a programmer and a composer to be able to do games. Right now, I'm about 50-50 split between sort of game audio technology consulting and still doing music and sound design for games.
Okay, well, if you started way back then you've seen everything. I mean, you've seen the whole evolution of it. What's the biggest change in game sound between... Well, I know when you first started, but let's just go back a little bit. What's kind of like the latest trend in game sound?
The latest trends? Depends how you define latest. Certainly, virtual reality, augmented reality is really huge right now. That's kind of what everybody's talking about. People are rediscovering technologies that, you know, were refined pretty decently 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Sort of 3D spatialization technologies, 3D sound. So that's definitely very hot right now. And that's, you know, it's been interesting to see the new platforms deal with that. Back when this technology was sort of first being commercialized, which goes back again to PC gaming in the mid-90s, you know, the mid-90s, the state-of-the-art personal computer was probably, what, a Pentium 1 33 megahertz computer with 1 megabyte of RAM and maybe a 20 megabyte hard drive. So obviously we have about three orders of magnitude more processing power. Our games are able to do these things, you know, with real-time convolutions and other stuff called head-related transfer functions to give illusions of 3D sound and 3D space.
The whole virtual reality thing warms my heart, because back in, you know, 1999, I was one of the first to get into surround sound mixing for music, and did 125 DVDs for all sorts of major acts.
Oh, wow.
So
that's awesome. Were these DVD-As, or were they DVDs with 5.1 music?
It was a combination. Started it for DVD-As and SACD.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually went to mostly video, DVD video, where it was more concerts than it was remixing the multi-tracks. And it was a matter of...
Right.
The major labels got cheaper as they went along. And what really killed it towards the end, besides the fact that it never really caught on the consumer end, was for us, we were doing three times the work for a third of the money. So, you know, it's that
right,
that whole
right.
thing where, you know, eventually it's like, well, I can probably make more money doing something else. Back in stereo, you know, as a matter of fact. But it's so nice to hear virtual reality coming back. And I've been following it closely on multiple levels. But I think gaming is really where ground zero is, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, gaming tends to be on the leading edge. You know, gaming, you know, in terms of surround sound in games, which really didn't appear until the original Xbox in 2001. That was real-time Dolby Digital surround sound that we stuck into the system there. And I know, you know, right now one of the big things people talk about is Dolby Atmos with object-based panning,
yeah,
the new thing. It's like, you know, I love the people of Dolby. I know them really well, but games have been doing object-based panning for about 25 years now. It's kind of the way we do it in games. And so it's nice to see it being adopted by, you know, movies and television and whatnot. But the genesis of that is definitely in the game industry.
Okay, so as a composer, you mentioned before how different it is to compose for a game as compared to a television or a film. And it seems that there's so many different paths that it could go down that it's not linear at all, that you're unlike a movie that you're doing.
You totally hit the nail on the head. The biggest challenge is you have this inherently linear medium, which is music, right? Goes from point A to point B. Trying to map that onto an inherently nonlinear experience, which is a video game, because you don't know when the person's going to go here or there, or whether they'll ever get to the big battle, or whether they'll just wander around a room aimlessly for 3 hours trying to find the lost key under the mat and never get any farther. So how do you provide a compelling musical experience for that? And there are a number of different techniques that have evolved over the years to try and deal with that, you know, in terms of breaking your music up into little chunks and stitching them together as the game plays, or breaking your music up vertically, where maybe you have different pieces. You know, you've got a, let's say, a fundamental rhythm track, but if the tension gets higher, then maybe the dissonant string track fades in to help you achieve that emotional state. Maybe you use a combination of the two. Maybe you've got little melodic pieces that just come in, fly over the top of whatever you have recorded. So there's lots of different things. And one of the fun things about game music, game sound design, is we really don't know what we're doing. So we're just kind of invent these things and we'll try them out. And some of them stick and some of them are like, oh, wow, that was a really bad idea.
Yeah. Well, isn't a lot of it the psychology, though, of the audio? Since it has to be compelling, it can't be boring, because you have to keep people involved, and that's one of the biggest ways to do it. So there's a lot of psychology there, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, there's different levels. You know, for the more cinematic type games, the big Xbox games that tell a story, obviously you have an emotional arc. You want to take the player into different emotional states, right? Marty O'Donnell, the composer for the Halo series and Destiny, likes to think of the game musician as the emotional puppeteer, right? He's got the audience on their strings and knows what little strings to pull to make the audience feel a certain way. And so trying to achieve that and still having something that flows and interacts naturally is always a big challenge. Then at the other end of the scale, you have things like puzzle games or freemium games, where the idea is to try and keep the player engaged in these little mini chunks. You know, I like to call them dopamine fixes, where you do something in the game and you get this visual reward and a sonic reward, and it makes you want to do the next thing, or, you know, let's be frank, it makes you want to hit the push here to buy 30 credits so you can advance to the next level more quickly.
Yeah.
So there's lots of different kinds of sort of emotional manipulation. That's the wrong word. Supporting the emotional state of the game.
Yeah, that, much better, yeah. Might as well be politically correct about it.
That's right.
Well, speaking of which, who dictates that? Is that strictly the composer that dictates that? Or what's the direction that you get as a composer?
Well, you're given these, again, it's kind of depends on the style of game. You're generally given the game design documents. And so you can get a pretty good idea based on the design documents. You know, the design document is kind of the analogous to a script in a movie. It's like, here's the game, here's what they do, here's what the mechanics are, here's what they do with the controller to get from A to B, here's the enemies they're going to face, here's the challenges they need to overcome. And so just like, you know, one of Hans Zimmer's really great fortes is being able to read a script and just knowing what he wants to do musically. You know, when should it be tense? When should there be silence? When is it time to ramp up the epic but cliche battle strings? And so I think a lot of times typically the composer will go through and have a good feel for what kind of mood do I want to evoke based upon what's going on in the game. And again, a good team usually will give the composer quite a bit of leeway in that.
Okay, well, speaking of the team then, what does the audio team consist of these days?
Again, it very much depends upon what kind of game. There's the $70 million plus budget games that take 3 years to make, you know, or, you know, $200 million games that take 3 or 5 years to make. And then there's the sort of more casual game is done in 9 months, and so on. For the first one, the sort of big budget games, audio teams have gotten pretty specialized. You'll have a composer, you'll have an orchestrator, you'll have multiple sound designers, you'll have an audio director, you'll have a dialogue coordinator. So an audio team for a game like Halo or Destiny, you know, might expand to be, you know, a dozen people. And, you know, some of which are contractors, some of which are full-time employees maybe of the company. So a lot of specialization goes on. You know, when Lenny Moore or Jack Wall or Gary Scheinman scores a movie, they really are just the composer, because it's a large enough budget to support the staff of people who will then take that music and do the technological magic to get it into the game, which is a whole nother thing. You know, who will set up recording sessions and prepare the sheet music and, you know, have, like I said, a half dozen or so sound effects designers who are doing all the interactive sound effects for the game and so on. So, you know, decent sized teams for that. On the other end of the spectrum, you've got small scale games. And, you know, these aren't necessarily college student eating tuna fish for a year games. These are professionally produced games, but they're just much smaller in scale. For those games, it's much more likely that they will hire one person to do the audio. I did a game for Nexon that's not released, and I'm the sole audio person on it. You know, Nexon's a major game publisher, but, you know, music, sound design, dialogue, recording, casting, that's all just one person.
Wow. That's a lot. That's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's obviously, you know, I'm not going off and recording 300 minutes of music like, you know, with the London Philharmonic like some games do, or going to Skywalker. But, you know, these games might have 20 minutes, 25 minutes of music that are virtual, maybe with a couple live players we bring in to make it sound better. The sound effects list is not daunting, you know, a few hundred sound effects. By contrast, some of these big budget games, you know, very epic games will have tens of thousands of sound effects they have to deal with and 80,000 lines of dialogue they have to record. And yeah, that you can't do by yourself.
Well, speaking of budgets, I know there's not a typical budget because there's different stratas of games in terms of the overall budget, but just in terms of percentage of the overall budget, where does that lie?
Boy, yeah, it's a great question. It's one I get asked a lot. And unfortunately, there's not a consistent answer to it, because it really does depend on so much, and it's hard to count sometimes. For example, most of the big studios have a reasonable number of full-time employees that, you know, run their audio department. Russell Brower, you know, was a full-time employee of Blizzard. He's one of the composers for the World of Warcraft series. And so you can say, you know, yeah, they will have, you know, a musician budget of, you know, $250,000 to cover a whole bunch of things, but they're still paying people's salaries on top of that. So it's a little bit difficult to totally categorize it. In general, you know, for a large scale game, if you took into account, you know, three or four full-time employees working there for 3 years, you know, let's say at $120,000 to $150,000 each per year, that's, you know, $600,000 to $800,000. You're going to have a bunch of contractors to come in and do a bunch of sound design. So the budget, audio budget for a game, let's say $200 million game, might be in the $3 to $6 million range or something like that. But again, that's spread over a period of time with a bunch of different people. On the opposite side of the scale, you might have a small-scale, professionally produced casual game where the entire audio budget maybe is in the $20,000 to $50,000 range. And of course, for indies, you know, it's tickets to a movie and pizza.
Yeah, it's a music business there too, right? Same thing.
Yep.
Yeah, right. Okay, let's come back to Game Sound Con. That's a big show. I was looking at the agenda. I'm sure it didn't start that way.
No, the very first one we had, again, in 2009, I think there were 45 people at or something like that. And it was a single room that we had. We've got five rooms now. And again, it was very targeted, just people who didn't know about games and wanted to sort of learn about them. We had some great panelists. Marty O'Donnell was on a panel. Nile Rodgers was... it was funny because as I see the people registering, I saw Nile Rodgers register as an attendee. And I wrote back as secretary. It's like, are you sure that wants to? And so we got talking and he volunteered to be on a panel. So that was great that first year.
Yeah, no kidding. But now that there's four tracks.
Grown since then.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've got four tracks plus the hands-on. And actually, we added a fifth one this year because we've got one track we call Game Audio Essentials, and that's really the Game Audio 101 boot camp over 2 days. We've got Game Audio Pro, which is the, you know, for people who have significant experience under the belts. These are the, you know, very advanced talks on game audio. What, you know, how is Madden doing their crowd sounds? How does Battlefield handle their weapon environments? Very specialized, detailed things. We've got a room dedicated for one of the game audio tools called Wyze. Another room for the Game Audio 2 called FMOD. And then this year, we added a new room that we're splitting one day of audio for VR and AR. And then the other day in that room is sort of academic research in interactive audio and game audio topics.
Wow.
The goal of that one is to bring the academic researchers who are doing cool techie stuff and getting them into a room to have drinks with the people who are composing and doing sound design for a living, and hopefully good stuff happens.
Yeah, that's awesome. Oh, that's very cool. There's a survey that you commissioned. Did you commissioned it, right? I read that right.
Yes. Well, I do the survey every year, and then this year, one of the findings, I commissioned a statistician to do some further analysis for me on.
Got it. And it was really interesting. I looked at it in your blog. It was broken into different sections, and wow. I mean, you really got down into the weeds on that and into exactly who game audio people really are and how much they're making. It was very cool.
Yeah, we're proud of this resource. So we started it 2 years ago. This is third year, 2014, we did it. Because there's such a black box around, you know, especially for people new to the industry. How much should I charge? Do I charge by the minute? What about ASCAP and BMI and things like that? And that's one of the business things that tripped a lot of people up. I had a composer contact me about 4 or 5 years ago. They were very upset because they thought they were being screwed by their game developer because he was asking about ASCAP registration. And the developer was like, well, you know, there's no, we don't do that. And he thought the developer was trying to be sneaky or steal his ASCAP money. And the fact simply is that there is no performance payments in games because games aren't performed in the sense that when a TV show or a movie is broadcast on HBO, that's considered a performance. And so ASCAP and BMI get money for that and they pay their composer. Well, the analogous thing doesn't happen. Playing a video game doesn't generate that income. So I had to explain to this person that it wasn't them being sneaky. It's just that that doesn't exist. And so having a resource where we could talk about how much do people charge, what are the contract terms, are there PRO payments, you know, do people use union musicians, things like that, we thought would be really helpful for people to have.
Yeah, well, it was definitely interesting, that's for sure. The one thing that, of course, was in the press release that I saw was about the female portion of game audio, where, unfortunately, it's the same for, in that industry as it is for every other industry where they make less. Although I was surprised at the numbers, at 10.4%, I think, were women. And that seems to be a lot. That's pretty good as compared to the rest of the industry, I think.
Yeah, I was actually pleased to see that. 2 years ago when we first did this study, that the number was 3%. Last year it was 7.5%. This year it was 10.4%. So it's either getting higher, which I believe is actually happening, although some of it might be people making sure that women pass the word about the survey around to other women, and I might be simply having a little bit higher female participation rate. That said, Billboard magazine did a story on GameSoundCon last year, and one of the questions was, do we have a breakdown of attendee by gender? Over a third of our speakers were women last year. And the best I could come up with is that by doing a manual check of all the names of the people who attended last year, about 20% of the people on the list had names that, to me, were most likely to be women.
Hmm.
So that would, mean even more than that are interested in doing games than the 10% that filled out the survey. So to me, that was a positive thing.
I have a lot of composer and songwriter friends, and of course, they're all looking for new opportunities and would like to get into game sound. They don't know how. What's a typical path to get into game sound?
Oh, wow. Typical. I don't know if there's any such thing as a typical path in anything in the music industry, is there?
Probably not.
It's a very, very networking-based industry. It's kind of who you know and who will trust you to do things. You know, there's a really, really big developers show in March called the Game Developers Conference, GDC.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people go to that to try and meet people. You know, everybody kind of catches their own fish into the industry. Getting some experience doing a game, whether it's, a small student game or an indie project that doesn't really pay a whole lot, going through the process once from beginning to end of doing a game is just incredibly helpful and can really, really help you if you're interested in getting into the industry in this part. There's another part of the survey that people sometimes look at, and that is, especially composers, what are the things besides just composing that people who are working in the industry actually doing for games? A lot of composers also do sound design for games. A lot of them also know how to take that audio and use these game audio tools I mentioned, Wyze, FMod, CRI, Fabric, Elias, and get it into these tools such that it can be more easily put into a game. Or some people actually know how to write computer code and literally can put the music into the game directly. So definitely expanding your skill set is something you really want to be able to do. Playing some games, too, is really, really good. People who work on games like to hang out and have people who love to work on games or love games to work on their games. That's not saying you have to be an avid gamer to be a successful game composer, but it certainly can help in terms of understanding what it is they're trying to do, which will make you a better composer, but also as you're networking with people, as you're meeting new people, new potential game developers that you want to, frankly, have hire you, that you have something to talk about, right? The last thing you want to have happen is you get involved in this great discussion, you're talking about baseball or fishing or, whatever it is with this person, and you kind of in the back of your mind, you're like, boy, I'd love to score their next game.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the question comes around, hey, what's your favorite game? What are you playing right now? And you're like, that's not really a good a good sign. You know, the thing I like to say is, you know, suppose you bumped into Steven Spielberg and you're like, hey, I really want to score your next movie. I'm the right person for it. I've got this great demo reel. And he asks you, hey, great, you know, sounds awesome. I'd love to hear your stuff. You know, what are, you know, what are your top five favorite film score scenes, you know, film scenes from movies that have been scored? And you said, well, I don't really watch movies, but I'd really like to score yours.
Yeah, yeah.
That probably would be a pretty short conversation. Yeah. So get out there and, you know, it's worth a few 99-cent downloads or, you know, $40 Steam purchase or Xbox purchases to see kind of what's out there and what's going on.
Is there a basic skill set that someone needs before they even get to that point? In other words, just, you know, a core set of tools that they have to know.
Yeah, and it's going to sound backwards, but it's really not. Being prompt, being punctual, doing what you say you're going to do when you're going to do it. That's number one. You got to be able to compose competently, compose to schedule, compose to spec. Because this is all with the assumption that you can write music, because there's a lot of people, you know, that's kind of the minimum bar you have to be is, yeah, you got to write competent stuff. You've got to know enough of the tech to be able to work your way around things. But there is a really big continuum between how deep you want to get technically. Especially as a freelancer, you're going to need to, you know, the more you can fit into their work environment, the easier you will be, you'll be with to work with. And by what I mean by that is, for example, you know, one of the issues of working on a game is that you have to be able to play this unbuilt game. It's not finished yet, right? They're still making it. But now you have to be able to play it, the whatever they do have working, so that you can, you know, how is my music working? Does this sound work the right way? Oh, my goodness, that's the wrong sound. They got it wrong. I got to let them know, you know, there was a problem in getting it into the game. That means you have to be able to run the game on your system. And this may entail some kind of technical things, you know, VPN, which is, you know, virtual private network, so you can access their corporate network from your office in Seattle when they're based in Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
It may mean being able to say, oh, geez, I got to update my graphics card driver because, you know, their game requires this new graphics card for it to run. And if they have to handhold you through every single little step, that's not as good a thing as if you go in and say, hey, yeah, do you use OpenVPN for your VPN? You do? Great. Just send me the .vpp file and I'll take care of it. Or are you using Jira to bug track? And you'll be like, no, we use this. And it's like, oh, yeah, no problem. I've used this. I've used Perforce. Not a problem. So to the extent that you can make everybody else's lives easier, that's always a big plus.
Yeah, 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 definitely. So, it's like that everywhere, isn't it?
Yeah. So, I mean, it is kind of silly that I didn't say, oh, Pro Tools or Digital Performer or things like that. But, again, that's kind of an assumed bar at this point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, last question. What is the best piece of business advice that somebody... music business advice or game business advice that somebody imparted to you along the way, or maybe you learned yourself?
Don't be afraid to take some risks. And that goes across all of the different things. This was told to me by John Tagenhorst when I was a jingle writer apprentice back in 82 or 83. You know, not just creative risks, because, you know, when you show somebody your demo, you don't want to be Hans Zimmer clone number 17. You want something, you know, take a little risk. You know, for me also that meant, you know, back in 1989, I quit my job at a game company that I loved to become a freelancer. You know, I quit my job at Microsoft, even though I was having fun at it, because it was time to be freelancer again. So take some risks in all the different kind of aspects of your career, whether it's, again, whether it's creative, whether it's business, and see what's going to happen, because nothing's going to happen if you don't kind of jump off the cliff. There may be another something really cool right down there that you land on that takes you up to a little bit higher peak. So.
Yeah, you're right. Great advice. Okay, what are the details on Game Sound Con?
So Game Sound Con this year is September 27th and 28th. We're back at the Biltmore Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. Two cram-packed days full of speakers from, you know, talks from some of the top names in the industry. So I'm excited to do, this is the 12th one that we've done. So I'm very excited about it.
Sounds great. And the website is?
GameSoundCon, GameSoundCon.com. And you can just Google Game Audio Conference or Game Sound Conference, and we'll always pop up.
To find out more about Brian, you can go to BrianSchmidtStudios.com. It's all one word, Brian. Schmidt is spelled S-C-H-M-I-D-T, so it's BrianSchmidtStudios, all one word, .com. And to find out more about GameSoundCon, you can go to GameSoundCon, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, you can send them to questions@BobbyOInnerCircle.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to BobbyOsinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to BobbyOInnerCircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes, Stitcher, Mixcloud, and Google Play. At BobbyOsinski.com and BobbyOInnerCircle.com, you'll also find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.